While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the Radio News Analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relation, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcoming you, dear listeners, here to your Wednesday session of the On the Radar, and welcoming you once again as we are pretty close to where many of you would be deciding to go on your holiday destinations. Do remember, guys, travel safely. Obviously, adhere to all road rules and do your best to arrive alive on the other side, specifically at your destination targets, wherever that might be, to the west, to the east, to the south, and to the north of the country. For those of us, specifically like yours truly, Dwight, here, staying stuck and put here in the capital specifically, which is always my forte during the holiday period. It gets a little bit more quieter, but nonetheless, always wishing the rest of you and fellow Namibians out there and fellow travelers out there, try to stay safe, try to, you know, drive safely and on a defensive notion. Obviously, the idea is that, try to bring down some of those particular road accidents and, let's not spoil each other's holiday period in such a cruel manner. Now, obviously, getting into the gist of today's discussion, and obviously before we actually start with that particular notion, do remember, guys, that I always still allow the particular participation and engagement that we always do here on your number one talkery station, and specifically on the radar. You guys can call 3-0-8-3-2-8-8-4-0-1, but that's only after we've finished the local news talking points during the course of today's program, and that's just slotted in between the local and the international news segment on that matter. Without much further ado, do remember that you can follow us on our social media platforms, which is from LinkedIn to Instagram to you name it, Facebook and the likes. Have a look there. Follow us for the regular particular updates that we bring you during the course of the day, and also stay engaged whether you're there on the socials or here on the radio programs. We love to hear sometimes also from you guys. Come through, engage, and let's do that. On the particular notion, starting in earnest with today's particular program here on your number one talk radio station, we obviously head into an in-depth discussion here for today's session of the On the Radar. And primarily, we take a bit of an active role or an active aspect in our discussion for today, because it is focused on the sports sector for Namibia. And this is obviously not just from the start of President Nandi Ndaitwa's inauguration back on 21 March, but rather slightly before that, because there were also developments that spanned from that particular time frame, heading into when she was inaugurated, and then after the inauguration itself, and also after the formulation of the cabinet itself, in terms of citing what particular developments obviously happened and occurred during the course of the sports calendar. Now, we could not include all particular sport codes because we had to touch on some of them, but there were notable developments, notable updates and talking points that emerged, in some cases controversial, other cases not, other cases negative, other cases pretty good, positive news and developments, and just looking towards forward positive developments. And on that note, dear listeners, we engaged with Eagle FM's own Hende Walenga, specifically from the Eagle Sports Zone that is hosted every Sunday here on your number one talk radio station. And we went into this particular in-depth conversation, looking at some of the key talking points, specifically starting from the missed opportunities on the two World Cup qualifications that we almost had. On that note, dear listeners, let's have a listen to this engagement. All right. And welcoming you, dear listeners, on this session of the On the Radar here for this afternoon session, where you join us between 1 and 2:30. And for one key discussion that we've got lined up for today, specifically as we are seeing the rest of 2025 fizzle out, in some sort of festive cheer. In other scenarios also, but a little bit of some talking points popping up here and there. But for today's scenario, we are looking at an in-depth discussion about the year that was in Namibian sport. For today's session, and to join me here on the radar, I'm being joined by my colleague Hende Walenga, who is the host, as you all know him as, by the Sunday Eagle Sports Zone, and alternatively also writes for the Villager e-paper platforms in the scenario of Everything Sports in Namibia. Hende, welcome. Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good afternoon, Dwight. I'm good. Thank you for having me. How are you doing this afternoon?
It's actually a good thing that the listeners also get to hear you during the course of the week instead of just on Sundays, ne?
Yeah.
So, Hende, starting off specifically on 2025's, if we can call it sort of like the year that was in terms of sports for Namibia, we've got to talk about the two big talking points, which was Namibia losing out on both World Cups, football and rugby. We tried following in our scenario about the football scenario because Namibia was moved from, their home matches were moved from South Africa to Botswana.
Yeah.
For some reason, it looked a little bit of a bad luck move. I won't throw any superstition into it, but it looked a little bit bad luck because suddenly we lost those matches. And then there was obviously Namibia who stumbled in Zimbabwe against Zimbabwe and who stumbled in Dubai, in the UAE against the last, you know, that last place for the World Cup in 2027. You can start from any point, but specifically in those scenarios, how did you see the developments in both of those codes actually fizzle out our particular dreams of firstly reaching FIFA and secondly, once again, securing an eighth place at an eighth participation at the Rugby World Cup?
Yeah, I think we can start with football. You know, there was there was great excitement around the Brave Warriors qualifying for this upcoming World Cup. I don't know if we can say it now in hindsight. I think we can say some of that excitement was a bit manufactured, I want to say.
Yeah, it was.
I say that because of the whole World Cup committee thing that was planned, which was a few, I guess you could say, influential people in the Namibian business, in the Namibian football world and business world, came together to, you know, on paper at least it was a good cause. I'll say that on paper it was a good cause to raise money for the Brave Warriors, so they can have higher prize money, etc., so they can have their expenses covered and things like that.
Yeah.
And I think their goal was to reach, let's just say, 10 million. It was 9 point something, but let's call it 10 million for the sake of the conversation. They had a gala dinner and everything, and you know, this created. Because we've never had anything like a World Cup committee for, as far as I know, for any sport really, especially not football. So it was an unprecedented initiative.
Nor were we close to qualifying.
Yeah.
Because remember that meet, that gala, happened just before we did the Botswana. I'll emphasize the Botswana matches.
Yeah.
But it happened just before that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's speak about the timing of this thing happening. This thing, from the outside looking in, it was like, I don't know, something that they thought about, like, kind of last minute kind of thing, you know? Mm. Something like this should have been in the works, like, at the beginning of the campaign, even beforehand of the campaign, so that we know, like, coming in, these are our plans, these are our realistic plans. I mean, there's a reason we've never qualified for the World Cup. It's not because we're bad luck or anything. At the end of the day, we're just not good enough to qualify for the World Cup. And, you know, we were in a group with a powerhouse like Tunisia. And so we had a few results go our way. You know, we got 3 points from FIFA from, the country's name is slipping me now, but we got points on a technicality essentially FIFA gave us because they fielded a player that wasn't eligible.
Mm.
So, you know, we had some things going in our favor. And I guess then that was swinged into this momentum for this.
Wasn't it the Niger or Benin guys? Were we with Benin? Yeah.
No, not Benin. I think, wasn't it one of the Equatorials?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll get the name in a second. But the point is, we were far away from qualification. On the field, you could see, like, we're not there yet.
Mm.
And, yeah, as things fizzled out, it was kind of like a disappointment because of the hype that was created, but at the same time, if you follow Namibian football, you know, like, this was way out of reach. I mean, it was just how many months ago we were celebrating winning our first match at AFCON, for example.
Mm.
So, and now to aim for the World Cup, even though now we're seeing countries that have never qualified for the World Cup because they've expanded it, but we still weren't on that level. So in that regard, I think there was some, like I said, manufactured hype about the World Cup. Would have been great if we qualified, but realistically we were never going to qualify, truth be speaking. And now as you sit here, I don't know how much money this committee has raised and where the money has gone, because qualification is done now, obviously. So it would be interesting to know exactly how much have they raised in total and who got the money. And rugby side of things, this was something that I think was kind of like the writing was on the wall kind of thing through the past. I mean, you'll know better than me. Through the past few years, our rugby has been on the decline, which is why we lost the Africa Cup, which is how we usually qualify for the World Cup. So I think this was a good wake up call maybe for the union and, now led by our very own Jacques Berger. So a good wake up call for them to reconsolidate and see where they can start again, see what was the issue this time? Like, why are other African countries now, basically taking Namibia's place? We used to be South Africa and
Namibia
at the World Cup. So now that place is being filled by a different country. So the other countries seem to be doing something right and we're doing something wrong. So it's a good wake up call for the union, I think.
And then there's obviously staying still on the two on that first discussion about the possibles that we missed out on, which was the two World Cups. There was one particular scenario, obviously, that has been bugging our Namibian football.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I only realized up until 2 weeks back, before I went to China, Football League will only kick off in this month. I'm speaking under correction because we didn't have a football league while the last qualifications were taking place.
Mm-hmm.
So that probably could have played a factor because we didn't have like match fit players at all times while the other guys at least started football leagues across.
Oh, yeah, 100%. That definitely played a factor. I mean, we had our guys training they were in preseason for months and months because they didn't know when the league would start, and then you get a press release saying, "Oh, the football will start in 2 weeks from now," or something. So, obviously, it doesn't help when our guys are not match fit when they have to play against powerhouses like Tunisia and things like that.
Mm.
So that definitely played a role.
And most of those countries obviously have professional players themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Our guys were still trying to find out, when is the league going to start?
Yeah.
On the other notion of the rugby, there was an interesting development since we were holding on to a record of at least qualifying 7 times. Mm-hmm. If you include France of 2023, we qualified 7 times in a row.
Mm-hmm.
This would have been number 8. And then, I could forgive what happened in Zimbabwe.
The Africa Cup.
Yeah. I could forgive. Yeah. Because obviously Zimbabwe went and pulled out all the stops.
Mm-hmm.
And we could have closed that game in Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
Because I watched the match. Besides the commentary that annoyed me because they were pro-Zimbabwe. But the thing was that we could have closed out that match. Okay, bygones are bygones because obviously no use crying about spilled milk.
Mm-hmm.
But when we get to Dubai, and here's the fascinating thing. I didn't know anything about the Belgian team until the commentator mentioned, while Namibia was literally 14-0 down by the 20th minute, first half, that 15 out of the 30-man team of the Belgian team that came to Dubai play in France. In the second division.
Makes sense,
As pros.
Yeah.
So it could explain their physicality, their energy levels, their stamina levels, and how they could literally outperform us in every facet of the game.
Yeah.
We couldn't keep up with Belgium. We definitely could. We couldn't keep up with Samoa, another team that has professional players in it.
Mm-hmm.
But we did beat the last place team, that was Brazil.
Yeah.
But that was also down to Brazil losing 2 players due to a yellow card and a red card in the match. So we were technically helped. Now, there is similarities, HD, that is seen between the FIFA campaign for Namibia, the Brave Warriors, and even the Namibian men's rugby team, is that we are still lagging behind in terms of becoming professional, and all our listeners will continuously ask this question.
Yeah.
What's up with the professionalism component?
Yeah.
And is there a great fear that we might be left behind in these two sports?
I think, I mean, football, one could argue, I mean, we were kind of behind to begin with. Mm. So I don't know how much further behind we can actually be left.
Mm.
But rugby, definitely, I think that's a kind of a, I think it should be a major concern, really. Because like you said, we've been, ever since we started at the World Cup, we've never not been at the World Cup. Mm. I mean, granted, we've never won a World Cup match either.
Yeah.
But we've always been at least at the point of
scoring,
of being part of the final. How many teams play in the World Cup? 32?
Yeah, no, not 32. It's not as, it's, I think it's like 25 or 26.
Okay, let's just say the final teams that playing in the World Cup.
Oh, no, sorry, it's 20. So it's five, yeah, it's five teams a group. Yeah, 20 groups.
20?
20 player teams.
So we've always been part of the, essentially the top 20 in the world. Those are the best teams at the World Cup, at least in the world, at least on paper.
Mm.
So now we've definitely dropped, a tier, if not two tiers down in terms of like our national, trajectory, our national strength.
Yeah.
So I think it's definitely a point of concern. I mean, we have to ask ourselves, what are countries like Zimbabwe doing now that they're able to compete the way that they have this season? So whatever it is they're doing is something I think we should look at either to, you know, copy or find a way to implement in ours, or just find what is needed for our rugby to get back to a competitive level.
Yeah. And obviously one of the key scenarios has been is a picture that you sometimes see, the guys that we select for the national team,
mm-hmm.
specifically in rugby, they're not the guys that you find in the local league.
Yeah.
If at most many of these are guys that get sourced from South Africa at the university level, mm-hmm. the varsity cup level,
mm-hmm.
the provincial level of South Africa, and sometimes playing pro in second division teams.
Yeah.
I think our highest placed professional rugby player currently is Kashi Deko. He plays for a pro 14 French team.
Okay.
The assumption is if it's not the Hargreaves guy, the Australian
mm-hmm.
that was born here,
mm-hmm.
who's at the Western Force,
because mm-hmm.
I don't know where he moved to. They are probably our two highest placed professional rugby players besides Lobsha, but the American Rugby League is not, is not considered of such a high level.
Mm-hmm.
So we obviously have a major issue with depth in both scenarios. If mm-hmm. you look at the football scenario, the concern would have obviously have been not just the match fitness, but also can we put up a good competitive contest overall?
Yeah, with football also, it's age is also a problem now, because you know the household names, the Otos, the Shaluliles, a few other like Nyambe, these guys that play abroad,
mm.
they're now, you know, getting up there. This is probably their last year, maybe 2 years going to be.
I think Otto's already in his 30s, right?
Yeah, all in their 30s for sure.
Yeah.
Otto, Shalulile definitely in their 30s.
Mm.
So, I mean, they don't have much left in the national team setup, or shouldn't anyways, because like I said, they're getting up there.
Yeah.
So, and then another big problem was the younger players that he did end up bringing in were, a big thing was the lack of experience that they had. So they were making a lot of, I don't want to say rookie mistakes, but a lot of mistakes that come with youth, let me say like that, because they haven't been playing football. So that's been a big problem. Like, phasing in that next generation of Brave Warriors probably hasn't been as smooth as the NFA would have wanted, which played a part in some of the performances that we've seen.
And the concern obviously also with our football team has been friendlies, because mm-hmm. I see that we only play competitive matches and then we've got to experiment in those matches.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
exactly.
Which probably adds into the rookie mistakes
mm-hmm.
scenario. Okay, I'll use the rookie mistakes. Exactly. Then just moving into the aspect of the cycling sector in Namibia. Hende, one of the interesting things has been that you've obviously gone to witness and follow the developments in the cycling event that took place in Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
That was back in September, I think.
September, end of September, yeah.
And obviously then there was the Desert Dash that you yourself competed in,
mm-hmm.
but obviously also the observation that you could provide from there.
Yeah.
How strong does it look specifically in the sector, the cycling sector for Namibia?
For Namibia as a whole, I think it looks very strong. From, in terms of, cause you know, the thing with Namibia is with a lot of our sports, we go to a lot of competitions and we participate, but we don't compete necessarily.
Mm.
And I think cycling, I would maybe say swimming and perhaps cricket.
Mm.
I would single those three out as the sports that actually compete when they go to international and continental, competitions. So cycling, definitely, we've had various cyclists doing well at various continental and international races I'm talking about now. Especially, and it's, the good thing about it is it's young cyclists as well.
Yeah.
So like Roger Surin, who finished on podiums in Europe. We have Olivia Shililifa, who won that, I can't get the race's name, but she won a continental race in Eswatini recently.
Mm.
So we, in terms of cycling, I think we have a very bright future.
Mm.
I think we can be one of the strongest cycling countries on the continent, following the likes of Ethiopia, Rwanda, Kenya. They are the top cyclists on the continent, but I think we can be in that second tier right below them, probably alongside South Africa as well. So I think cycling is in a good place for sure. We do well, and even our local competitions, I'm seeing a lot of participation from especially the youth, which has been good to see, but really from people of all ages, like the Desert Dash you mentioned. You'd be surprised, there's people like 65 years old, 70 years old cycling across the Namib Desert. So I think cycling is probably in the best spot it's been as a sport in its existence, I would say.
And the interesting thing is obviously also every day, well, obviously where our studio stands, we see a lot of cyclists here.
Mm-hmm.
People casually doing this.
Yeah, it's become a very recreational activity. I'm seeing that people are picking up. Mm. Kind of like how running has become a big thing in the country.
Mm.
And I think it's also spreading across the continent. Like I said, the likes of Rwanda, the likes of Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia,
South Africa definitely has.
South Africa for sure.
Yeah.
Eritrea, you know, these countries are all producing super strong cyclists now. So, and I think that's part of the reason why that competition you mentioned in Rwanda, why it was being hosted there, is because cycling is on the rise in the continent and the cycling world is taking note of that also. So it was good to see, Africa get that opportunity with the Road World Championships that were hosted in Kigali.
They obviously, these were teams from across the world, right?
That participated. At the World Championships?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All of the world's best cyclists, guys that competed at the Tour de France and things like that, they were all there.
Which is obviously good to know, because for any cyclist out there, if you have ever watched the Tour de France, which is considered the most grueling,
race, 100%, yeah.
And then followed by Giro d'Italia and the Vuelta a España, and then you've also got the South Africans trying to generate their own sort of like prominent races.
Yeah.
I just keep forgetting the one in Cape Town that they constantly have.
The cycling race?
Yeah. I keep confusing it with the Cape Argus Marathon. But it's
not sure, actually.
It's not a marathon, but then there's also a discussion in terms of, besides the list, was it the Eswatini one that you mentioned?
Mm-hmm.
There's also one that's held in the KwaZulu-Natal area. But you can obviously see that cycling has its appeal because it's a multi-day competition format. It's not just over one day. And that's obviously some of the things that we as Namibians, we haven't tapped into yet.
Yeah.
Now, when we obviously look at that World Cycle Championship that was held in Rwanda and the Desert Dash, it's not really the same discipline of cycling, right? Because just for our listeners, just describe the two so that they know, okay, a bicycle is part of the thing, but what kind of a bicycle?
So the one in Rwanda, that was called the UCI Road World Championships.
Mm.
UCI is like the international governing body of cycling. So the FIFA of the cycling world.
Yeah.
So Road World Championships, meaning they were only cycling on the road, like the Tar Road, the road where that cars drive on. The Desert Dash is kind of a mix, actually, because it's primarily takes part in the desert, so gravel cycling. I guess it's technically mountain biking, but also there's some sections of the course that are on tar, so it's mix. So the Desert Dash, you ride on a mountain bike. whereas the road world championships, for example, you ride on a road bike.
Mm-hmm.
So two different
disciplines
yeah. for
and,
sure. Yeah.
And obviously Desert Dash was almost like a 24-hour thing.
Yeah, Desert Dash is a 24-hour thing, 401 kilometers from Vintek to Swakop. Whereas the road world championships, you first start with your time trials, which are usually just like 15 or so kilometers.
Yeah.
And then, there's like team relay competitions.
Yeah.
Then there's, another individual, road race.
Yeah.
Where you go like, I believe this year the men, they did, I want to say 175 maybe kilometers around Kigali.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's different disciplines.
Yeah, and obviously much of it was based upon the best team that can perform, obviously in that scenario. But
mm-hmm.
cycling obviously tests your endurance as a human as well.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Just like marathon running. I want us to get into the next chapter as well, HD, because primarily this has been sort of like Namibia's success story in sports so far.
Yeah.
Which has been the cricketing developments.
Mm-hmm.
So we've partly seen Namibia's women's cricket team,
mm-hmm.
Perform their best. We won, right? Against those visiting seven African teams.
When they were here?
Yeah.
I think we lost in the final.
We lost, yeah.
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 But we made the final.
Yeah, but we made the final. So we performed very good
mm-hmm.
because that final.
Smile if you can hear this message. You are blessed. You're alive. You may also realize that Christmas is not about the presents anymore. Christmas is about the gift of love. Your smile is contagious. It is that smile that kept everyone going at ShopRite and Checkers this past year. Thank you for your support. ShopRite Checkers wish you a fabulous festive season.
Yeah, but we made the final. So we performed very good
mm-hmm.
because that final was supposed to be the qualifying round for another qualifying.
Yeah,
round.
It was like a precursor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we did pretty well in that for the ladies.
Mm-hmm.
There's obviously the under 19 men's World Cup that we'll host here in Namibia at the newly opened cricket stadium.
Mm-hmm.
Namibia is also set to host a part of the Cricket World Cup in 2027.
Yeah.
And all of these things just spell positive after positive after positive for the sport code itself.
Mm-hmm.
How has this particularly looked when you look at this particular one sport code?
Yeah.
Just growing, growing and growing. What does it translate to you specifically?
I think it's a good example of what leadership at a sporting federation can do.
Mm.
I mean, ever since the current CEO Johan Miller has been there, they've really just been on the rise. And I interviewed him before on the Eagle Sports Zone, and he explained that he didn't take over. Like what it is now is not what he took over. He said like they were millions of dollars in debt. They had a bad reputation and all these kind of things. So, you know, they had to put in a lot of work to get to where they are now.
Mm.
But the fact that they were able to succeed, they were able to build a new stadium essentially financed by themselves. Like they went out and got the money. They have great developmental programs around the country.
Which also pay people.
Like they pay their people. There's no, you know, a lot of times in sports in Namibia, we hear it's on a volunteer basis.
Yeah, or you must volunteer your time.
Exactly. No, cricket, they pay people and they pay their players, most importantly.
True, that
they and the national team players at least.
Yeah.
So the guys coming up in the guys and girls coming up in the ranks, they know that if I make it to the top, I'm going to become a professional and earn a living salary by playing the sport of cricket.
Mm.
But yeah, no, I think in general, I think it's remarkable what they've been able to do in such a short amount of time. And I mean, when the stadium was announced was
2023, I think.
Wasn't it even after 2024, maybe?
Last year?
I think it was last year.
Yeah, it was last year, yeah.
I mean, even if it was 2023, I mean, that's 2 years ago.
Yeah.
If we think about all the other stadiums we've heard about in this country that have been announced now for some now 5-10 years, where absolutely nothing has happened, and then these guys come in and build a stadium in essentially 18 months or so.
They set themselves a target.
They hit the target.
Yeah.
They, you know, were able to host a big team like the Proteas. I mean, imagine if we could host Bafana Bafana in Namibia.
Mm.
That's essentially what they did on the on the cricket side of things. So I think they've proven what leadership can do. And when a federation is like singing from one hymn sheet, they prove that, that good things are achievable in sport.
And definitely possible, because we've even seen, even though like the award ceremony that they sometimes have, it looks glitzy. It looks very, you know, everyone basically knows each other in that scenario, but you can see that there's real growth and real development taking place. The first two sports codes that we actually started on, the rugby and the football scenario, they still command a very strong position in the Namibian sports market.
Yeah.
If we can call it a market for that matter.
Yeah.
The reason being is that you can see with the cricket side, with the cricketing developments happening, is that it was Namibians that showed up predominantly and sold out the tickets for the South Africa, should we call it the experimental South Africa team? Because it was sort of like, an experimental team that was here. But still, there were some big names.
Yeah.
And it was predominantly Namibians that I heard that bought out the tickets just for that one Saturday, got there, and it was just fun. And everything was just going well.
Yeah, people are very excited for that fixture. I mean, I had people asking me for tickets. Like, I work for Cricket Namibia, so it was a great moment of unity.
Yeah.
And people showing like patriotism for Namibia, which we don't see often in Namibia. So it was a good day overall for Cricket Namibia, and it was a. Like you said, football and rugby are easily our most popular sports, but it's cricket that's the shining sports federation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's why they've won the Federation of the Year award at the Sports Awards like 8 years or something in a row now.
And that shows real promise. I mean, because even talking to the, talking primarily to him, but it was a question that was fielded by one of the sports journalists back in, I think it was June, July, specifically to Mr. Muya from the Sports Council. You know, what should be done? And this was because of this was posed towards the Disabled Sports Federation, who also had a change in leadership. And the bare bones answer was, you know, if everyone could do what the cricket guys are doing, you know, you sort your own issues out.
Exactly.
You set your own strategic plan and you achieve your goals. Then, everyone would be talking and singing your praises.
Exactly.
So just as a final particular question on that development, Hende, if we look at cricket's particular success, is it based on internal goals and achievements, or is it a scenario of still relying on the government or the ministry, the line ministry, to come and sort out the sport codes administrative side?
No, it's 100% it's internal. Like I said, it starts with the CEO, Johan Miller, who's actually a South African.
Yeah.
So I don't know what it says about our local like talent pool, that we needed a South African to come and essentially sort out the sport of cricket. And if I'm not mistaken, the rugby is doing the same, gonna bring in a South African
for the total administration.
I believe so.
But that would be a positive.
Yeah, but I'm saying the fact that we're saying it's a positive that we're bringing in a foreigner.
Yeah.
That to come sort out our problems. I'm saying I think that's kind of an issue. But regardless, it's definitely internal.
Mm.
I mean, you never hear anything bad about Cricket Namibia. You never hear about, oh, so-and-so stole whatever.
Not even in terms of a public relations scandal.
There's
no such thing.
Never.
Yeah.
But I think before Johan came, he was saying like those were some of the things that were on the Cricket Namibia name. So it definitely fixed that. So it's 100% internal doing. I actually don't even know if Cricket Namibia gets any type of government support. Like in terms of finances, I don't know. I'm sure they get something,
but
I know it's not something that they rely on.
Yeah, and obviously that has been the biggest question. Obviously, also in Namibia, is that people have distorted this image that government must be involved in sports development.
Yeah,
but in many cases, the pictures that I see in England with their football, with their rugby, with their cricket, South Africa the same, New Zealand and Australia the same, because we follow their models.
Yeah,
Zimbabwe also follows the same model.
Yeah.
Is that you've got this independent entity which says, yes, we adhere to Ministry of Sports, as, which we don't have anymore. Mm-hmm. It's now MASAC. We adhere to MASAC's particular goals of mm-hmm. inclusivity and development of the program, but the aim is still there to ensure to look after the affairs of the sport.
Yeah.
And so far, it doesn't seem like we're following what the South Africans are doing,
mm-hmm.
the English, the New Zealanders, and the Australians.
Yeah.
Because we literally follow that model.
Yeah.
So just on that note, you know, is it still a good thing that we keep it as independent as possible because we have a good example of Cricket Namibia?
Yeah, I think so. Because that's, I mean, that, like you said, that's like an international thing. It's not specific to Namibia, Cricket Namibia. So I think we should definitely still follow that model, but we should like actually follow the model in practice, not just on paper. I mean, I know football now, they said next season the Premier League will be run by an independent body. So we'll see how that goes. We'll see who is even going to be on that body, which might be another issue. But yeah, so I don't think the model is the issue. It's more the implementation is the issue.
And then we obviously get into the overall talking point of local sports news development.
Mm-hmm.
Hende, there's obviously been many things. For example, if we touch on things from NDP6, NDP6 wants certain things to materialize in Namibia's sports sector.
Mm-hmm.
Out of all the sport codes that we've spoken about, which is not everyone, we've not exhausted everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So far, the cycling and the cricket have positioned themselves as the best sport codes.
I would add swimming to that also.
Swimming as well. I also want to add hockey and netball.
Okay.
Remember the article that I wrote about netball announcing that they want to, that they're going to have a
professionalization thing?
Yeah, which is not fully, but it's sort of like to help with sort of like some sort of an allowance factor.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also hockey because the hockey is currently in South Africa. They were competing in the Inkosi Cup.
Yeah.
Which the women reached the final against South Africa and the men were kicked
out of the
semis. Yeah, yeah. By, I think it was Australia or New Zealand. The USA. No, we beat the USA. No, it was South Africa that kicked out.
I think it was South Africa.
It was South Africa, yeah. So in the sports development scenario, does it look like we're getting some sort of attraction and a positive direction from these particular scenarios?
Yeah, I think in terms of sports development, so like talking about the youth specifically, I think we're making strides there.
Mm.
I think in terms of swimming, that we have I don't know if we've ever had a talent pool of swimmers this good. Because every competition we go to, it seems we're always collecting medals in swimming. Cricket, we just spoke about, they're doing well on the developmental side.
And they've got an active development program.
Yeah, they have an active nationwide one. Yeah. So a lot of people don't seem to be aware about, because a lot of people say, oh, it's only, you know, the thing of cricket is, you know, they're saying, oh, it's just the rich white kids playing cricket and so on. But it, as you and I know, that's just not true.
Yeah.
Through their,
because they've taken it as far north as possible.
Yeah, yeah. Places where I'm sure, like, football hasn't even gone. Cricket has gone in the country. So developmental-wise, cricket, swimming, cycling, I think we can add netball to that. They're on the right path. Let me say it like that. They're definitely on the right path. If they can get some further assistance, whether it's from the government or the private sector, I think we can do some good things. The only problem is, you know, once the athletes get out of the youth phase, the developmental phase, the problem is what's after that.
Mm.
Yeah, that's the.
And it's always a scenario in terms of, what they're getting now as a young person, can it sustain them?
Exactly.
Into their 30s and even going ahead.
Yeah.
Because the biggest question of professionalism has always been, it must be livable wages.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. A person must live off the thing and must be able to sustain themselves.
Yeah.
There's also been a scenario, if we look at, obviously, in sports development, has been infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
I know our biggest headache is the two stadiums that technically, and I still want to put that bad luck situation there, is that we still don't have any clear indication of Independence and Sam Nioma.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, City of Windhoek only now recently in this year hosted the was it the engineers or the bidding process for them to look at what are the issues.
Yeah.
But weren't the issues already highlighted by CAF?
Yeah, no, they appointed an engineering firm to do like some structural, I forget the technical term, but it has to do with like the base, or what do you call the foundation of the stadium.
Mm.
So that's what they were contracted to do. Whether that's begun or not, we don't know at this point. Honestly, at this point, I'm like almost jaded by the talk of Namibian sports stadiums, because every few months there's an announcement that we're going to do so and so. You know, it's just, and sometimes it's just announcements about announcements.
And then they're calling us out to come and to come and cover this announcement about an announcement.
Yeah, they say, come cover, we've appointed so and so, come cover, we've resolved so and so. And then, you know, months down the line, you ask follow up questions, when is this happening? When is what happening?
Mm.
You get nothing. So at this point, until I see like an actual completed stadium, or no, not even completed stadium, until I see work being done on a stadium is when I'll, actually start to get excited a bit. But for now, it's just talking, basically.
Yeah.
In regards to stadiums.
And then there's obviously also that in much of the stadium development or the infrastructure development is that a lot of it is based upon who has to look after it.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to ask you in a short summary, who do you feel should look at, when it comes to a football stadium, who should look after a football stadium?
So if a stadium is built,
let's say by the local authority.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the local authority's job to
look after
it. Whether it's to appoint a third party, which is what, you know, most stadiums in the world, that's what they do.
Mm.
It's owned by the city, but ran by a different company.
Mm.
That's how the Hage Geingob Stadium is. It's owned by
the rugby union.
Actually, I don't know. Is it the rugby union?
They still own it, but you are right on the third party.
It's owned by the rugby union, but it's ran by a media company or a marketing company.
Mm.
They handle like the, if you want to book it, you contact them. You don't contact the rugby union.
Mm.
So that's, in short, that's what should happen to all the stadiums. So if a stadium is built on Dangwa or wherever, for example, it's the town council's responsibility to make sure that everything is in good shape.
Mm. And on the extras, if we have to look at other sports news developments, obviously the main headliners have always been rugby, the football, cycling featured a lot, cricket as well. We haven't seen much in the realms of tennis. Hockey was a very small snippet until the day that I showed up specifically at the final matches.
Yeah.
And the announcement of the allowance, the professional allowance for next year was announced by MTC.
Oh, netball, you mean?
Yeah, for netball.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's hockey. We obviously don't know, you know, to what extent, you know, what the development programs from there also look like.
Yeah.
Just in those limited scopes. What have you seen for specifically in any other sports code as well?
In the other sports codes, the developmental side I see is really just through the schools. So like your school leagues, whether it's hockey or any other sport, school hockey, what other sports are they? Basketball.
Athletics as well.
Athletics, all of that is usually through the schools. So in terms of, but obviously the school year has come to an end.
Mm.
So we'll wait to see next year where some of these sports will be. On the senior side, going back to football side, we don't actually, as we said today, we don't know if there will be a second round of games for the Premier League.
Because
remember, they got money from the government, but that was only enough for this first half that we played now.
Mm.
So we'll have to wait for another announcement in the coming weeks to hear what's our Premier League football going to look like. But in terms of other sports, yeah, it's just the schools, really, as far as I know, is where the developmental aspects take place.
Okay, so like the main core of that developmental aspects.
Mm-hmm.
And on that particular note, Hende, if there's still something you wanted to add that I might not have asked, you can still do so.
Maybe on the Desert Dash, the prize money.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people know about the prize money or the Dash. So in the solo category, the first place, which was Trikis this year, they get 40,000. Second place, 23,000. Third place, 16. And then it scales all the way down to 10th place. 10th place got 2,000.
Yeah.
Namibian dollars. That was in the men's. So the prize money is in the same for the women also. So the first solo woman also got 40,000. And, In terms of teams, the two-person men's team, which was the category I was in, first place got 26,000, second got 15, third got 11, and on the in the four-person, first got 20,000, second got 12,000, third got 10, and there was also a half dash, so they started at the halfway point.
Mm.
For the solo, first got 5,000, second got 3,000, third got 1,500. And yeah, overall, since it was my first time doing the dash, like you said, it was I definitely understand the hype now. I see why people come from all over the world, really, to compete in this.
Like, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Like, people come from the race that Jikas won.
Mm.
The guy in the lead was like a European champion, a guy from Germany, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm.
And then like 60 kilometers to the finish, he had an issue with his tire.
Mm.
So he couldn't finish, and that's how Jikas won. So there's people that come from South Africa, people come from Europe, people come from USA. They come for this Nedbank Desert Dash. And after having competed in it, I definitely see the why people do that, and it's definitely a staple on the Namibian
cycling calendar.
Just sporting calendar, really.
Yeah.
I'm willing to say it's our biggest sport event that we host, like on a yearly basis.
Mm.
I don't think we have anything that compares in terms of, one, number of participants, because there's over 1,000 riders, and two, the economic impact, they say, is around 20 to 25 million each year that the Desert Dash contributes to the Namibian economy, and I'm sure Swakop gets a lot of that as well. So, yeah, I think it's definitely, I'm willing to say it's our biggest sporting event, yeah, for sure.
No, that's good. That's good. And obviously, I can see a lot of the sports tourism associated to it.
Because yeah.
It was one of the talking points that David and I, we wanted to ask earlier at the launch by the NIPDB's Namibia Convention Bureau.
Mm-hmm.
And part of meetings, exhibitions, and events, usually you find sports tourism central to that,
because
a lot of those people also need to hospitality, and they're mostly here for more than 5 days or more than 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually a good thing that you cited there because of the continuous contribution it does.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, it would be nice to have someone from Swakop actually talk about what this does to the town every December.
Mm.
But after having been there, I can definitely see, like, I could see and feel the impact.
Yeah. And on that note, Hende, once again, thank you for taking the time. Dear listeners, this was Hende from Eagle Sports Zone, just sharing with us some of the particular developments looking back at 2025 here on Eagle FM's The On The Radar. Hende, once again, thank you.
Thank you for having me, and tune into the Eagle Sports Zone every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m.
Now, coming back, dear listeners, from that insightful discussion, as you heard just there, with Eagle FM's own Hende Walenge, who's from the Eagle Sports Zone, in terms of the every Sunday broadcast or the every Sunday show that you enjoy here on your number one talk radio station. Obviously, there's still further developments, and as cited, unfortunately, we couldn't talk about all of the sports developments happening in the country, just the major ones, and specifically what they cited in terms of the way forward. Now, this also then gets us into our next particular talking point, specifically here on the radar, as the Ministry of Agriculture engaged with stakeholders in Lüderitz on Tuesday. Now, this is as Minister Inga Zamwani highlighted that the key reason for this engagement is that the management of Namibia's fishing resources is key in the sustainable use, as well as also the particular application of resources around the marine resources themselves. Now, the minister stressed that the resources need to be rebuilt, as there is great concern in the current way that the resources are being managed. Let's have a listen to what she cited.
So, according to NDP 6, we are asked as an industry to rebuild. The terminology is rebuild our aquatic resources to maximum sustainable yields. So the scientists of the ministry, I don't know if any one of them is here, but since I have come to the ministry, they have been hammering on this MSY. Minister, we must ensure that the MSY is sustainable. So I asked them, what is this MSY? And they explained to me how, when they do their assessment, they are noting less and less fishes of childbearing age and more smaller fishes and also very scarce. It's not so easy anymore to go and put your net and come out with fish of sufficient quantity in less time. So you need to put in more effort. And that is what NDP 6 is saying. Cognizance of the decline of the biomass, we must start rebuilding it. Now I'm asking myself, how do we do that? Because as the ministry responsible, we set the total allowable catch per annum based on the evidence that we are receiving from our scientists. And consistently for the last 5 years, our scientists have been telling us reduce at least by 10 or more percent the TAC. But the industry, when we reduce the TAC available by that amount, it means every right holder will have to carry the pinch. So as we are just about to allocate the horse mackerel quota for the next season, prepare yourself. There will be a reduction in the quota that you received last year because of the declining biomass that we are experiencing. The other target that NDPC expect from us is to ensure the industry contribution to the GDP. Now, currently, the contribution of the fishing industry in its broader sense is 10.4 billion American dollars per annum. Yeah, so NDP says that by 2030, we must increase that contribution to 10.7. Mindful of the challenges, they have given us a small target of only 300 million additional that we must add to the GDP. So the point is, where will that 300 million come from? Each one of us as right holders have to pitch in and make our contribution. We cannot look to Novanam alone, or Agana, or Seaflower, or the rock lobster industry to bring all that together. So part of the purpose now, as you are planning for your operation next year, try to see whether you can increase your collective revenue by X percentage. So the mathematicians amongst us will tell us 300 million is, if we have to divide among the right holder, how much is that? So I would simply say that as a good businessman or woman, you're always planning to increase your revenue by over inflation or at least in line with inflation. So why don't we also, in that way, if we think that way, then we can make a meaningful contribution towards that collective target. And then there's also an expectation, an obligation on us as an industry to reduce the illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing from our waters, the IUUs. And we all know, in one way or another, if you are an industry player, who are those companies and from which countries are those vessels flagged that comes and fish illegally in our waters? Now, you have to protect your resource because you are competing not only with the IUUs, but you're also competing with the other big guys out there that eat mercilessly, like there's no tomorrow. You know who I'm talking about? The ones that live in the water, come out to sunbathe and go back, the seals. And I learned today from Novanam that actually the seals are consuming more than the total allowable cash per annum. Or even he said, I'm putting it mildly, he said the biomass. So if the seals are eating more fish that we are supposed to be fishing and landing, what must we do? Is that not a collective challenge and a problem for all of us? Maybe the rock lobster people, the long line people are saying, ah, that's not my problem. The problem for the post mackerel people, problem for the hake people. But if there's no hake to be caught, and if there's no horse mackerel to be caught, guess what? Everybody will start catching crayfish. Yeah? And the biomass of crayfish is so small. But you know, in 1 year we can all finish it. And then, lastly, I just pick a few points in terms of the NDP targets, is that we must add value to the fish that we harvest from our marine reserve, from our ocean. And there is a scope for more value addition in some of the species. We are aware that maybe some of the species, the scope for value addition is not great because the market demand that the fish be landed in whole. Like the crayfish, I don't know how much value there is to add there, because they want the whole crayfish on your table, but I'm sure there's opportunity there. So the achievement of these ambitious targets require us to collectively develop our action plan. And I'm challenging the associations, the various inter-subsectors associations, to look at NDP6, to develop their plan, what they are going to contribute, and submit that to the ministry so that we can put it in the cooking pot and we can come up with an industry plan at the end of the day.
Now, still staying on that particular engagement by the minister with the stakeholders, specifically in Lüderitz, the minister also highlighted that there are specific goals that are targeted, there are specific target goals stipulated in NDP6 that have to become a that have to see the fishing industry become a contributor to the overall revenue and earnings that the state collects every financial year. Now, the minister noted that the stakeholders have to be part in sustainably achieving these goals as cited in the National Development Plan 6. Let's have a listen to what she added.
Your operations are central to the achievement of NDP6 goals, and we must make sure that the contribution of the industry over time is increased. The Minister of Finance will be here maybe later today or tomorrow, and when I told her that I'm going to Lüderitz to engage with the industry, she asked me to ask you, what is your projections in terms of the taxes that you are likely to pay, in terms of the levies that you are likely to pay, and in terms of the pay as you earn that you are likely to pay from your operations next year? I was with the Novanam today. They shared some of their figures for last year's performance. So in my mind, I was able to have a workout of how much more or less I can expect from Novanam. But I want to hear from you also, when we meet, what is your revenue per annum? what is your cost? How much tax do you expect to pay to the state? Because we are harvesting state resources, and the rent that we pay is the taxes that we pay. So it is not too much to ask that we make a meaningful contribution towards the development of our country. To go back to the issue of rebuilding the stock, the participation of the industry in these efforts are going to be very critical. And when our focus should not be only to harvest what is currently naturally in the ocean, there are other opportunities that we can pursue. In Douglas, for a long time, I know that there has been an industry here of abalone, oysters. They have been growing them, they have not been harvesting them from the ocean, but growing them. So there is great opportunity for mariculture as well as aquaculture. I'm glad to see that there are players here today, African, where are you? Are you in the room? The one that are constructing a salmon farm. They're not here. Oh, okay. But there is a big player here who's putting up a big salmon farm that is going to, according to their estimates, going to be creating thousands of jobs. And that is one way we can reduce our heavy reliance on natural fishing from the ocean. We are, most of the time, we eat salmon here and we are told it's Norwegian salmon. Some of that salmon is not naturally occurring in the Norwegian seas, but it's actually from the mariculture industry that is well developed in that country. So why not us following suit and taking advantage of that opportunity? Aquaculture, I don't know how much aquaculture activities are here, but honorable councillors, honorable your worship, the mayor, for places like Aus, where you have enough underground water.
Now, coming back, dear listeners, that obviously brings us up to the end of the local news segment and just where we left off there, primarily with the indications and the engagement that the Minister of Fisheries, well, she's not only the Minister of Fisheries, she's actually Minister of Agriculture, Water, Fisheries, and the Land Reform is still there, I think. Now, that obviously brings us into, past the two-thirds section of today's show. We'll quickly be taking a short break and coming back right after that.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have the capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the reading news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
And now coming back, dear listeners, we head into our international news segment, specifically here on the radar, and we step into developments that have been popping up specifically with regards to the Ukraine and Russia conflict in the Northern Hemisphere. Now, this is as developments are spearheading up fast and some updates coming through specifically that there might be further engagements between the heads of state regarding a peace plan going forward. But there are other particular sideways developments popping up in terms of accountability for a war and damages caused to Ukraine. Now, this is as Europe's bid is, or as Europe is trying to bid to hold Russia accountable for war damages to Ukraine. Now, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky joined European leaders in The Hague to launch a commission for reparation payments worth hundreds of billions of euros for his country. The International Claims Commission for Ukraine will assess the damage that was caused by Russia in Ukraine and determine the levels of compensation. Now, the effort will be coordinated by the 4-6 member Council of Europe. While many other member states strongly back the plan, some fear legal repercussions. Now, this follows 2 days of entirely separate talks in Berlin that were aimed at reaching a peace deal to end the war. We have a listen to this report.
President Volodymyr Zelensky has joined European leaders in The Hague today to launch a commission for reparation payments worth hundreds of billions of euros for his country. The International Claims Commission for Ukraine, as it's called, will assess the damage caused by Russia in Ukraine and determine adequate levels of compensation. The effort will be coordinated by the 46-member Council of Europe. While many member states strongly back the plan, some fear legal repercussions. Well, this all follows 2 days of separate talks in Berlin aimed at reaching a peace deal to end the war. President Zelensky told the Dutch parliament that the discussions in Berlin and in The Hague were vital for long-term global security.
This is not only about diplomacy, not only about physical security. It's also about making Russia finally learn to live by the rule of law. And it will only work if there is true accountability, if the punishment of the aggressor becomes inevitable. Yes, it's not easy, but it's not as difficult as some may try to portray it.
Well, DW's Jack Parrick is also in The Hague, where the International Claims Commission was officially established today. He spoke to Alain Berset, Secretary General of the Council of Europe, the pan-European human rights body that will coordinate the effort.
34 countries plus the European Union all signed off on the setting up of the International Claims Commission for Ukraine. It's a body which will hopefully allow Ukrainian people to claim compensation for the destruction that has happened in their lives as part of Russia's war against Ukraine. Now, the Council of Europe is the body that is going to be taking charge of this commission. And I have the Secretary General of the Council of Europe, Alain Berset, with me. Tell us, how is this going to work? What is the plan? How will Ukrainians get money out of this commission?
I mean, the goal is clear. The goal is to bring reparations for the destruction in Ukraine, for individuals, for companies. I mean, the goal is really to have compensation and reparation. But, you know, one step after another, today we are creating the legal framework with the Claims Commission. And it is really a very important step. It happens 2 years after the register of damage, making more concrete what will happen. And then we need to have a discussion on the funding and make sure, yes, it is the goal to have really reparations for all the victims.
Now, as you say, the funding, where this money will actually come from, is unclear. You don't decide that today. Where do you think it might come from in the long run?
I'm quite sure it will come from different sources. You know, I mean, it will come from different sources, from countries. There is a discussion on the Russian frozen asset, clearly. We have some countries already having decided to have some money for reparation and reconstruction in Ukraine. It could be part, you know, also of the reconstruction and reparation made in the context of the claims commission. I mean, this will be the discussion that the states signing the convention and participating to the claims commission will have to do in the next in the next few weeks and months. First of all, we need to have signatories, states joining, and then we need to have the ratification process. And it will take some time. I hope it will be fast. We need to have also a strong will of the countries to do this, this happen. But we need also to have respect for democratic processes in the countries joining. And it will also ensure the stability that we need for a claims commission and for this work.
International commissions like this are sort of famously, they struggle to have the effect that they want to have. Why do you think that this one for Ukraine will work where others may have failed?
First of all, there is a huge political momentum. I mean, it's clear what's happening today is history. I mean, it's the first time ever that for a convention of the Council of Europe, we will have 34 countries plus the EU signing at the very first day where it is possible to do this. This is a huge political momentum, first point. This political momentum follows what happened with the register of damage, you know. We are doing one step after another, and it can take, it takes time. That's true. But the most important thing is to be in movement and to have, reparation and to have accountability at the end. Because, you know, the very simple question we try to answer is, do we want to live in a world where destruction, war, violence and impunity will prevail? Or do we choose a world where rule of law, accountability and peaceful
care that helps you care for others? That's the basic mental health first aid course, free for NHP members. You learn how to spot early signs of mental or emotional distress in friends, family, or colleagues, and how to guide them to the right support before small struggles become bigger problems. Learn more and register for free at nhp.com.na. T's and C's apply. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
We come back from the short break and continue where we left off with that report.
Questions and dialogue prevail. That's exactly the question that we have in this context.
Alan Bursat, thank you so much for joining us on DW.
Thank you. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky concluded 2 days of peace talks in Berlin confident a deal on security guarantees for Ukraine is within reach. On Tuesday, he joined allies in The Hague to launch a commission for reparation payments worth hundreds of billions of euros for his country.
More than 30 countries, as well as Ukraine, formally approved the creation of a mechanism to compensate Ukraine for the damage caused by the Russian invasion and the war which followed. While it's not clear where the money will come from, the new commission means Ukraine will be able to seek financial assistance.
Russia will never voluntarily pay for the damage it has done. We already see the attempts to exclude reparations and, in fact, any form of accountability from the potential peace agreement. And this puts a huge responsibility on the international community, including the participants of this International Claims Commission. Together, we must stand up for the victims of this brutal war of aggression. If we do not, more will follow.
The cost of the Russian invasion and the war in Ukraine is estimated to run to hundreds of billions of euros. Critical national infrastructure, such as the energy grid, have borne the brunt of the Russian onslaught, along with civilian housing. The compensation fund should help Ukraine in the long run. In the meantime, the diplomatic drive to end the war is being stepped up, with European leaders holding talks in Berlin this week and Ukraine willing to give up on NATO membership in exchange for US security guarantees. Speaking in The Hague on Tuesday, Zelensky gave this update on the negotiations.
The American partners have received the European reaction. The American side will now contact the Russian side. And after that, there will be a meeting with Ukraine in the United States. I think in the coming days, perhaps a little later. We hope it will be as soon as possible.
Donald Trump believes a peace deal is closer than ever. Zelensky, seen here meeting the Dutch king, Willem Alexander, wants any agreement to be tied to compensation, saying Russia, as the aggressor, must be made to pay.
I'm joined now by Yevgenia Kravchuk. She's a member of the Ukrainian Parliament for President Zelensky's Servant of the People Party. Welcome back to DW, Yevgenia. Let's start with the latest. The Council of Europe today established an international claims commission for Ukraine. They want Russia to pay for the damage it has caused in Ukraine. How meaningful is this move if the biggest issue, the funding, is still unresolved?
Well, I happen to be in the delegation to the Council of Europe, I mean, the Parliamentary Assembly of Council of Europe. So I've been since the day first of this process, because it does have to be a mechanism which is practical. Right now, the Register of Damage is already working for the applications, and we already have 80,000 people that filed applications. It could be, you know, the ruined house or Russians killed a loved one, or someone was in captivity or still in Russian captivity. So these are very, you know, say personal things. And obviously, people ask me as the member of parliament, we represent people, when will be this justice, correct? So when we'll see the reparation coming? So it is the big question, but it's something we have to do, is the third part of this comprehensive mechanism, which is the fund. And obviously the best option is to use the frozen Russian assets. And well, it's very good that these Russian assets were immobilized without the need to be, you know, to prolong the immobilization every 6 months in European Union. And European Union is part of this claims commission. It's co-signature, and we saw the higher commissioner Kaja Kallas today in The Hague.
There's no consensus on these frozen assets, of course. Let's look at the talks that were held until yesterday in Berlin. How were they different to earlier rounds of talks?
Well, it is a process. We are thankful both for United States being a mediator in the process between Ukraine and Russia. And by the way, I think it's more correct to call a Russian war, not the Ukrainian war. Ukraine didn't start a war with itself.
Of course.
Yes, but again, we're thankful for Germany and for Chancellor Merz being in the room together. And then there was the meeting of European leaders that could attend during that day, because Ukrainian security is also European security and vice versa, because Russia is still, you know, planning and rebuilding the army to be able to attack European countries and to be able to face the war in, you know, to put it further. So obviously a strong Ukraine that has a big military production, that has a strong army, is an absolute necessity for Europe to, you know, to survive in this world, because we see that the world order that we are used to, you know, probably I would say is not, you know, existing anymore if we are seriously considering.
Now we head into our next particular talking point that shows some of the aspects in terms of the global transition from the fossil fuels into newer, renewable and cleaner energies. However, there's been a little bit of a development as Europe, the European Commission, is proposing to reverse its own ban on the combustion engine vehicles from 2035. Now, the European Commission has proposed reversing its ban specifically on internal combustion engines, and the revised rules soften the target to 90% reduction in auto emissions from 2021 levels. The Commission says the move is a more pragmatic approach that will help support European car makers. Let's have a listen to this.
Proposed reversing a ban on all new combustion engine vehicles from 2035, the revised rules soften the target to a 90% reduction in auto emissions from 2021 levels. The Commission says the move is a more pragmatic approach that will help support European car makers. The decision has been praised by German Chancellor Friedrich Merz and is also a relief for Germany's troubled auto industry.
Welcome to Buhl, a quaint town in southern Germany with a bakery, a pedestrian zone, a Gothic church, and plenty of charm. But another important part of Buhl used to be its auto industry. It long brought wealth and economic stability to the region, but times have changed.
We can directly feel the economic crisis. The entire region depends on the auto sector.
We're at the Schaeffler plant, visiting one of Germany's largest auto suppliers. The mood isn't great. The company criticizes the EU's goal to put an end to diesel engines by 2035.
What we see actually in the year 2026, the end customers are not buying as many battery electric cars in Europe as anticipated. So missing infrastructure, no conviction about the technology, and then banning one of the key technologies end customers would accept, we regard as extremely critical as of today.
This is the main production hall. Schaeffler has recently adapted and is already producing electric engines. But the company's main business is still making parts for gas and diesel engines. The idea that they won't be needed much longer sounds like a threat to many here. Volker Robel is on the employees' council and acts as a spokesperson for the Schaeffler workers.
Last week we had an employees' meeting. We had a poll. About 50% of us said that they're worried about their jobs.
The problem? The government wants climate-friendly cars, but they want jobs too. The auto industry makes up 7% of the EU's gross domestic product. The EU exports cars and parts worth 170 billion euros, and almost 14 million people work in the sector. The industry worries about its future post-combustion engines, as that's a technology where European companies are leading worldwide. It's a point Matthias Zink has made in Brussels, too. He's not only on the board of Schaeffler in Germany, but he's also president of the interest group of European auto suppliers.
Our scenario is that we should open up all the different technologies, that we should stick to the carbon reduction target, but it should be a fair technical competition.
For now, Brussels has received the message. The EU has tabled the matter of banning new combustion engine cars. The mayor of Buhl is pleased.
I don't think we have to drop our climate goals, but we need to develop our technologies and communicate that clearly.
The mayor supports electric vehicles and combustion engine cars, hoping they both will secure jobs in his town.
For a closer look at how the EU's U-turn on the combustion ban is going down in Germany, let's bring in DW political correspondent Simon Young. Simon, Germany is the EU's top car producing nation. What have reactions been to the announcement here?
Well, Nicole, Chancellor Merz, as you would expect, he's welcomed this announcement in Brussels. He, of course, was partly responsible for persuading the European Commission to change tack on this matter. He wrote to Brussels a few weeks ago, urging them to find an approach for the automotive industry that, as he put it, combined innovation friendliness with technological openness and was good for both industry and the climate. Well, that's a politician's way of saying give our car makers a bit more time to build vehicles that are both fossil fuel powered but also using new synthetic and biofuels and of course electric vehicles as well. So he's very positive, but the German automotive industry has been sharply critical of this. They say it doesn't go far enough. They say it looks like openness, but in fact it's fraught with hurdles and may in practice be ineffective. On the other hand, you've got Volkswagen, which is Europe's biggest car maker, saying they think this is pragmatic and economically sensible and they can work with it. And then again, you've got environmental groups saying that, you know, this is a betrayal, really, that it goes in the wrong direction and it weakens Europe's car industry in the technological race with China.
Why has the German car industry been struggling so much with the transition to electric vehicles?
Well, I think there are many reasons, as you saw in that report. There is some criticism from the industry about environmental rules, but as the European Industry Commissioner said, you know, this is partly about addressing those difficulties, but the challenges are much bigger than that. There's sluggish demand among European consumers. Europe's economy is in the doldrums, and there have been problems with prices, you know, for electric vehicles, for instance. There have been subsidies, then they've been withdrawn. People are very price conscious. At the same time, I think in Germany, Germany's been slow to sort of roll out the infrastructure that you need, the charging stations, and so on. So people have been uncertain. But it's also this question that where do you position yourself in a technological race, in particular with China, which has been surging ahead? You know, it's not just about the big marks like BMW and Mercedes. It's like we saw in the report, these smaller components and parts manufacturers who need to find their role in a sort of electric car and more diversified fuel source car industry in the future. Those are big questions, and I think changing policy at European level like this could just add to the uncertainty and make it more difficult for European car makers to really find their place going forward into the future.
Sounds DW political.
Now that also brings us up to the end for today's session, specifically here on the radar. Now, stay tuned for the rest of the programming in our company. Obviously, as we always do, right after the end of today's program, you can stay tuned for the Onkundana Dingi team, specifically as they'll be providing you with the next particular programming after the break. On that note, enjoy the rest of your programming in our company. Let's see each other again, same time, same place.
While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relation, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.